Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for, what is this, November 8th, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. In fact, after a long absence, got two interviews up tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll hear from Diva Pager, who's a sociology professor, author of a book called Marked, about her experiments sending guys with and without criminal records, black and white guys with and without criminal records out to apply for jobs, and rather interesting results she got. Nut graph, as they say in the journalism business. It's worse for your career to be a black guy without a criminal record than it is to be a white guy with one. Most amazing piece of social research I've heard in some time. And then at the bottom of the hour, an interview recorded a few weeks ago with Tariq Ali about events in Pakistan, recorded before the state of emergency was declared there, but nonetheless the political analysis is still sound and intelligent, as usual. And also talking about other things, Iraq and Latin America. So the political world tour, courtesy of Tariq Ali, a little bit before the half-hour mark. And in the weeks I've been away, we've been fundraising, and thanks to those of you who pledged during the drive, and don't forget to send your money in if you haven't done so yet. Well, I was away doing that was all happening. The financial turmoil that began over the summer has returned and deepened. What does it all mean? As I've been saying for months, while the problem started in the subprime mortgage sector, it's gotten a lot wider than that. It's the unsurprising consequence of the intense bubble in the housing market for which there is really no precedent in American history. We've had speculative housing bubbles before, but never anything like what we just saw. Prices rose more and for a longer time than any time in U.S. history. It's not too shocking that a bubble so profound should end with a bust like this. But it's gone beyond that. Wall Street financed this boom with an array of complex securities that spread throughout the world financial system. Banks, institutional investors are holding securities that they thought were safe that are now turning out to be toxic. But no one knows just how bad things will get. No one knows how all these complex instruments devised by the finest minds on Wall Street will ultimately behave. I mean that quite literally. No one, bankers, regulators, economists, or pundits, really knows how this will all turn out, which is part of why the markets have been freaking out so badly. When you don't know how bad something might get, it's pretty easy to panic. Nor do we know what the spillover effects of the housing bust will be on the rest of the U.S. economy, or of any bust in the U.S. economy, what effect that will have on the rest of the world. Last Friday brought the regular monthly employment report for October. It showed a modest rate of job creation, but there's reason to believe the job market isn't doing as well as the statistics reported. Now, it's not that the government is making things up. It has to do with the technical way used by the techniques used by the statisticians, which generally work well during normal times but are often slow to catch up with turning points, and we could well be in the middle of one of those turning points. Next Wednesday brings the report on October's retail sales. The magnificence in housing kept consumption levels up despite weak job and income growth. With that prop gone, will the American consumer stop spending so much money? And what will happen in the sacred Christmas retail season just about to begin? Again, we just don't know. There's certainly no reason to be complacent. Risk levels are very high right now. Given the levels of household debt within the U.S. and U.S. debt to our overseas creditors, the possibilities of a worsening financial crisis followed by a deep recession are quite real. But there's no reason to go to the extremes that some analysts are suggesting. For example, Mike Whitney, whoever he is, has been filing some apocalyptic stuff on the Counterpunch website. Today's report opens, quote, "America is finished, washed up, kaput. Foreign investors and central banks around the world have lost confidence in U.S. markets and are headed for the exits. The dollar is sinking, the country is insolvent, and its leaders are barking mad. That's bad for business. Investors are voting with their feet. They've had enough. Capital is flowing to China and the Far East in a torrent. It's sayonara downtown Manhattan and hello Tiananmen Square." End quote. Yeah, the U.S. economy has a problem, but washed up? Kaput? Probably not. And the rise of China has been, in no small part, a byproduct of demand coming from the U.S. So if the U.S. is kaput, what then is China? When you write stuff like this, you run the risk of sounding barking mad yourself. Anyway, more, much more, in the weeks to come. All right, let's turn to the interview I recorded a couple of weeks ago with Diva Pager. who is a professor of sociology at Princeton and author of the book Marked, which is all about the impact of having a of jail on the employment markets and also the impact of race on when combined with a prison record on one's prospects for employment. The book is very interesting, and Diva Pager is a lively interview. So let's listen to this. Diva Pager.
It may seem like hard to believe right now, but about late 60s, early 70s, people thought prison was a fading remedy for crime. Could you just review that moment for us before we proceed?
There was a lot of research and political support for the idea that the rehabilitation of offenders was best handled in the community with appropriate supports and with a lot of attention to reintegrating offenders into society rather than separating them from society, which prison obviously does. And so there were historians and politicians and social commentators who predicted that over time we would see decarceration and an increasingly rare use of prison as a means of handling the problems of crime. And in fact, we've seen just the opposite. Since the early 70s on, prison has grown exponentially, so that every year since 1972 until this past year, we've seen an expansion of the prison population.
It's also hard to believe, but the incarceration rate of the percentage of the population behind bars was pretty steady, except for a little boomlet in the 30s, from 1925 through the early 70s, right?
That's right. It was very steady, and it was very comparable to what we saw in other countries in Western Europe. The U.S. was very much average in terms of its use of prison as punishment. And since the early 1970s, we've really moved away from the way most other Western industrialized countries use incarceration. We've become the world leader in the use of incarceration, and we've really become very, very exceptional in this respect.
So what happened?
What happened? Well, that's a complicated question, and there are many answers. I think one answer is that there was some research that came out around that time that showed that actually maybe the goals of rehabilitation weren't as effective as we thought they might be. And so instead of thinking about trying to rehabilitate offenders, we should focus more on the simple and straightforward goal of punishment. There was also a lot of political disruption and turmoil happening, obviously, in the late 60s and early 70s, and Nixon in particular really capitalized on the sense that mass social disorder was affecting our communities, and that being tough on crime and really cracking down on the problems of crime and social disorder more broadly would restore order to societies, and that was an incredibly popular political platform. And obviously, as we've seen, every politician since that time has really vowed to be tough on crime because that is such a popular political platform to take.
That was also about the time the economic golden age was coming to an end and things were getting a little rougher in that sphere. Do you think there's any connection between what happened with the economy and the approach to crime?
Well, some analysts would say that that prison is a useful way of regulating difficult economic times. Prison removes large numbers of otherwise largely unemployed young men from the workforce, and it's sort of a labor force institution in that respect. Our unemployment rates are significantly lower, in part because so many of the most disadvantaged workers are held behind bars and not counted in our labor force statistics.
Yeah, let's fast forward to the present. The corollary of the fact that the prison admissions have increased so dramatically over the last three decades is that prison releases have also increased dramatically. What fate awaits people as they're released in prison? Is there any kind of social support as they leave the doors?
There are more than 650,000 prisoners being released every year. And ironically, at the same time that we saw a retreat from the idea that prisons could rehabilitate people, we also saw a kind of loss of confidence in the institution of parole as being a really effective mechanism for helping offenders to reintegrate. And so since the early 1970s, we've also seen a decrease in funding available to parole offices and less attention to trying to help offenders reconnect to work and families. and more attention among parole officers to regulating offenders and to reincarcerating them if they break a range of rules of their parole. And so there are actually fewer and fewer services, at least offered by the state, that aim to facilitate the process of reintegration. And as a result, we see high rates of failure. More than two-thirds of former prisoners are rearrested within 3 years of release, and a large number of them are reincarcerated.
You make it sound as if there's been a transformation in the role of the parole officer. Was it once a supportive kind of role, and that's gotten transferred into a more of a gotcha kind of role?
Very much so. So in the early 1970s, at the start of the prison expansion, parole officers really saw their role as being one of linking an ex-offender to various forms of social support and social involvement. So the parole officer played an active role in linking an offender to job resources, to substance abuse resources, to other kinds of community supports that have been shown to play a role in reducing recidivism. And over time, in part because the caseload of parole officers has more than doubled over that period, so parole officers really don't have a lot of time to spend individualized attention with parolees. But also the orientation has changed. It's much more about enforcing rules than about providing any kind of assistance.
What kind of employment prospects do people face when they get out of prison? We'll get to your contribution to this, but what have other scholars found about the effect of a prison record on someone's reemployment possibilities?
Generally, the employment outcomes of ex-offenders are bleak. So studies that have followed ex-offenders a year after release find that about three-quarters of them remain unemployed in the year after their release from prison. So it certainly appears that this is a group that really struggles to find employment after serving time in prison.
All right, so tell us about the study you did.
Okay, so in this study, I constructed an experiment in which I hired young men to pose as job applicants, and I assigned them fictitious matched resumes that reflected identical levels of education and work experience. And on one member of each team, I had that individual report to the employer that he had been recently released from prison and had served 18 months for a drug felony. And I had members of the teams switch off each week so that each week a different member of the team would present himself as being the ex-offender to control for any differences.
There is a common critique of these sorts of things that you just can't control for everything, so you may be missing in some sense that these are not really identical applicants, so you're missing something. But your design corrects that, is that right?
Exactly, because each member of the pair spends some time playing the role of the ex-offender and sometimes playing the role of the non-offender. And in this experiment, I had two young white men and two young black men playing the role of the job applicants to look at how the effect of a criminal record may vary by race. So this study took place in Milwaukee, and these young men applied to hundreds of jobs over a period of about 6 months, and I looked at which ones received callbacks or job offers from the employers, depending on whether or not they had presented evidence of a criminal record. And there are three major findings that come out of this research. The first is, not surprisingly, having a criminal record is a major barrier to employment, even for these low-wage, entry-level type jobs. The jobs these young men were applying to require no more than a high school degree and limited work experience.
I'm speaking with Deva Pager, who is a professor of sociology at Princeton and author of the book Marked, Race, Crime, and Finding Work in an Era of Mass Incarceration, recently published by the University of Chicago Press. And, unfortunately, just as she was listing her three major conclusions, there was a glitch in the audio, and we lost that portion. Fortunately, the third conclusion was so dramatic that I asked her to repeat it, so we'll pick it up with that repetition.
That's a remarkable finding, which, you know, I think it almost can get lost in the rest of the results. I mean, it's almost worth repeating that a black guy with no criminal record gets about the same rate of callback as a white guy with a felony record.
That's right.
Now, some of the there have been examples of these kinds of racial tester studies in the past, and people have criticized those because, again, you might not be getting the characteristics exactly right, so they're not perfectly matched pairs, so the results aren't valid. But your study design corrects for that, right?
Well, it can't correct for all of those critiques, and certainly there may be something that I, as a researcher, missed in matching my white and black applicants. But I worked very hard to make sure that the characteristics, both the interpersonal characteristics and also the characteristics, the objective characteristics presented by these applicants on their resumes, were identical, and did everything in my power to reduce differences across these job applicants.
And this was done in Milwaukee. Has it been done anywhere else?
Well, the book that just came out, Marked, Race, Crime, and Finding Work in an Era of Mass Incarceration, deals specifically with the case of Milwaukee. But since that study, myself and Bruce Western, one of my colleagues, replicated the study in New York, and we find very, very similar results.
What is the legal status of ex-offenders? Is it legal for employers to discriminate against them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in most states, employers can use a criminal record in whatever way they choose. But in a few states, Wisconsin and New York among them, there are additional legal protections for ex-offenders so that employers are instructed that they can't discriminate solely on the basis of a criminal record and have to look at the relationship between the specific crime and the particular job responsibilities that they're considering the job applicant for. And so employers are warned that they can't simply eliminate applicants on the basis of their criminal record generally.
So they're not allowed to ask questions about criminal records, in other words?
They can ask questions about criminal records. So it's interesting. Employers are allowed to ask about the criminal record. They're just not supposed to use the information indiscriminately. It's not at all clear what the effect of these laws might be, but those laws are in place.
I can understand an employer being careful about someone who might be convicted of assault or theft or something like that, but a drug crime doesn't necessarily reveal all that much about the character of the applicant. It's a pretty common thing, and a lot of people in prison are there for fairly minor drug offenses. So have you been able to determine what the reasoning of the employers is?
Well, I think there are lots of good reasons that employers are concerned about hiring anyone with a criminal background. First of all, it indicates a willingness to break the law, which is something that employers would be concerned about. And employers are also concerned about substance abuse and any of the behaviors that might be associated with a substance abuse problem. And so employers certainly have a legitimate reason to be cautious in hiring people with criminal records. I think the problem is more one of public policy and for society more generally, that we have an interest collectively in making sure that ex-offenders find jobs, even if individual employers may not see that as their own personal interest. We know from other research that finding steady quality employment is the strongest predictor of desistance from crime or whether or not an offender will return to prison. And given the huge numbers of inmates that are flowing out of prisons and into communities each year, if we don't think about their reintegration possibilities, that will have implications for public safety more generally.
You call the ex-offender status the credentialing of stigma, which is a catchy phrase. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I think this is a way in which we have increasingly begun to rely on formal certifications and formal labels for sorting people into different positions. So increasingly, jobs require a high school degree, a college degree, an occupational license. There are all sorts of credentials that are required for access to various positions within society. But there can also be negative credentials that similarly affect whether or not someone becomes eligible for a position or an occupation in our society. And this is one of them. A criminal record is this official certification of someone's behavior, but also provides a certification of some assumptions about their moral character. And in this way, the state, by increasing the kinds of crimes, the kinds of behaviors, and the kinds of people that are brought under the jurisdiction of the criminal justice system, we've really increased the use of this particular kind of credential and made that information publicly available in ways that have profound consequences for various kinds of inequalities that result.
And we touched on this a little earlier, but let's expand on it. Are there any kinds of policies that could be pursued that would make the life of the ex-offender a little easier?
Yeah, and let me emphasize that, you know, I think these policies should be thought of not simply as trying to make the life of the ex-offender easier, but also trying to promote public safety more generally, that we really all have an interest in getting ex-offenders employment. And I think there are a number of policies that should be pursued more actively. So one is that is sort of thinking about the role of intermediaries. As I've said before, parole has basically retreated from a process of trying to link ex-offenders with families and jobs and housing and other sorts of social and community supports. But there is a new model that has come onto the stage, which is intermediary organizations that are sort of like job agencies, but that also provide a range of social services. And their aim is to build relationships with employers and to help to match ex-offenders with employers that are willing to hire them. And I think this is a particularly important strategy given that, you know, employers have all of these legitimate concerns about ex-offenders and find it difficult to be able to effectively identify which kind of criminal record signals continuing trouble and in which cases is this someone who legitimately wants to get back on track. And intermediaries can help in that screening, training, and supervision of workers to make sure that we are placing ex-offenders in jobs but not putting anyone else in harm's way. So that's certainly one policy that I would advocate as a way of helping to facilitate the transition.
And what about just a general retreat from our incarceration media? Are we doing ourselves any favors by putting so many people behind bars?
Well, I personally believe that we are not doing ourselves any favors by putting so many people behind bars. It costs an incredible amount. And though I think that incarceration has been associated with some reduction in crime rates, it's not the most powerful or the most effective way of reducing crime. And I think there are all sorts of evidence, there's building evidence to suggest that it actually creates all sorts of new social problems by producing such incredible disruption into people's lives, into families' lives, into communities' lives. And so I think this is certainly an area that needs rethinking. Though, you know, I'm more pessimistic about the possibilities of reducing the size of the prison population anytime soon, simply because politicians that attempt to lessen sentences or reduce prison populations are accused of being soft on crime, which is, in this political climate, certainly not something that's going to win any votes.
And that was the voice of Diva Pager, who is a professor of sociology at Princeton University and author of the book Marked, which is all about the effect of prison on employment possibilities, and especially the effect of race plus prison on employment possibilities. That book published a month or two ago by the University of Chicago Press. And this is WBAI, doing a little early station ID, a few minutes early. This is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial and at, on the web at WBAI.org. And again, thanks to those of you who pledged during our recent fundraiser. And if you owe us some money, please don't forget to send it in. We need every penny we can get our hands on. I should say, my name is Doug Henwood. This program is Behind the News, and we're here every Thursday talking about the worlds of economics and politics, or almost every Thursday talking about the worlds of economics and politics. And next up, an interview recorded a few weeks ago with Tariq Ali, who is a remarkably prolific writer, journalist, novelist, filmmaker, world-traveling pundit who knows a lot about many things. And Tariq is originally from, although he lives in London now, is originally from Pakistan. And so I opened this interview with some questions about what has been going on in Pakistan. Some of this, what he says, was rendered obsolete by the weekend declaration of a state of emergency by President Pervez Musharraf. Tariq was traveling and unavailable for a quick update interview, but he did provide this commentary by email. Musharraf's decision to impose a state of emergency was announced while Admiral William Fallon, boss of the U.S. military's Central Command, was visiting the general headquarters of the Pakistani military in Rawalpindi. Journalists in Pakistan are alleging that the U.S. greenlighted the new coup, and certainly the regime wasn't shaken to the core by the mild criticisms from the White House. The question now being posed is, how long will Musharraf last? Could he have signed his own death warrant? And that's the end of Tariq's comments. In the piece for the British newspaper The Independent the other day, Tariq described Musharraf's state of emergency as a coup within a coup, since he took power in one of those in 1999. There have been some flirtations with democracy, but not enough for the population, which has been growing increasingly vocal in their critique of Musharraf, so he declared martial law over the weekend. Okay, so here's the interview with Tariq Ali. We just had an election in Pakistan. Musharraf got something like 99.999% of the vote. What happened and what do you make of it?
Well, I mean, what took place in Pakistan was totally predictable. Musharraf, still in his army uniform, wanted to get a new mandate for another 5 years, and he got it from a dying, defunct provincial and national assemblies instead of waiting for new elections. These assemblies had been rigged in the first place, so the result was more or less predictable. The opposition parties, principally the moderate religious parties, boycotted the assembly and didn't participate in the vote, nor did one or two other small parties. The party of Benazir Bhutto, the Pakistan People's Party, the principal secular party, just abstained from the vote. That was her order: do not vote against, and do not boycott, but abstain. So what that meant, if the PPP had voted against, it would have been close. But with this decision to abstain, it meant that Musharraf got a clean ride. And, you know, so he's elected president. The point is, Doug, that no one in the country takes it seriously. The people don't take this election seriously at all. Everyone knows it's a fraud, it's irrelevant, it doesn't matter, and that the future of Pakistan is going to be decided elsewhere.
Is Bhutto sort of an heir apparent, or what is she, and if so, what does she represent?
Benazir Bhutto represents the largest political party in the country, a party which grew out of a massive resistance to the military in the late 60s and 70s. Her father, who was the leader of the party, was arrested, charged, and executed, with the U.S. giving the green light. And Benazir Bhutto inherited the party from her father and will not let go. For the health of this party, it would have been much better once she was accused of corruption and she fled the country, didn't want to face trial because the charges were by and large true. Instead of resigning from the party and letting it function, she held on to it as if it was a family fiefdom. And this party is now thoroughly discredited. I was in Lahore the day the deal between her and General Musharraf was announced. And that same night, people came out onto the streets of the city and chanted a slogan in Punjabi, which is the language in Lahore, which, if translated politely, goes something like this: marvel at the People's Party, half whore, half pimp. And this is the attitude of lots of people, that this is a corrupt party with a corrupt leadership, obsessively interested in power as a means of making money.
There were some signs that there was some dissent within the ranks of Musharraf's own government, a couple of assassination attempts, which looked like they had some inside assistance. So how stable is his reign going forward?
Well, it's not stable because he has now antagonized virtually every social layer in the country. He's antagonized civil society by the way he's operated vis-a-vis the Chief Justice and the Supreme Court. They've won a temporary victory, but nonetheless, Musharraf has been very seriously discredited by the way he suspended the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and then, under massive pressure, had to allow his reinstatement. He's isolated on the right because they played with the jihadis, they allowed them to keep the mosque, they allowed the mosque to become an arsenal, and when the jihadis finally opened fire and torched the Ministry of Environment for good measure, they decided enough was enough, though the thing that finally triggered the confrontation with the jihadis off is they began to attack sort of massage parlors, and one of these massage parlors had Chinese workers, and they kidnapped 6 Chinese women, at which point the Chinese embassy stepped into play and they sent a very stern message saying, if our workers are not safe in your country, relations could be damaged, and that triggered off the final assault on the mosque. So the thing needn't have reached that stage. Instead of becoming like the sort of Waco massacre, it could have been stopped in its tracks early particularly in January when it became known that these young clerics were stockpiling weapons in the mosque, which is a government-owned mosque built on government land. So he's alienated them, he's alienated civil society. The bulk of the population is totally alienated from the entire elite, Musharraf, Benazir Bhutto, everyone. So it's a very grim situation in the country. And, you know, the attempts on his life are not surprising.
Where are the loyalties, if any, of the intelligence service?
The intelligence service so far is loyal to the military high command. The level of autonomy this intelligence service enjoys has been, in my opinion, grotesquely exaggerated because it suits the military. It's the soft cop, hard cop approach. They say the intelligence services did that without our knowledge. This is not credible in Pakistan, where the head of the intelligence service is responsible to the chief of staff, the commander-in-chief of the military. And the fact that the latest head of the intelligence service has now been promoted to be Musharraf's successor confirms that view. These are people all in it together. Sometimes they use one faction or one grouping within the military to do certain things so that they have deniability. And that is what has been going on.
And what about the relation with the Taliban? There's stories about operations in the wild northwestern frontier against the Taliban. What's going on?
Well, there are operations against the Taliban, and largely whenever the military needs a bit of cash, they go in and fight on the western frontier. And that same month, a direct invoice goes to CENTCOM in Florida, which is paid directly to the army. It doesn't come by the state treasury or anything. And they say, these are our expenses, these are how many soldiers we lost, this is the weapons we used. I mean, they have a detailed invoice which CENTCOM pays up to. So, you know, the cynics in Pakistan say, they must be short of money, they've waged a big thing, they're claiming they killed 200 people. Well, fine, 200 people's quite a lot. No one believes how the stuff coming out of there.
What is the relationship between the government and the Taliban in Afghanistan?
Well, the relation is as follows, that when the Afghan business started, the Pakistani military, Musharraf and most of his generals, advised the Taliban not to fight. Said, do not resist, it's pointless, you'll be killed, the Americans are determined to take the country. So the overwhelming bulk of the Taliban did not put up a fight. They dissolved. They disappeared, both in their own mountains and into Pakistan. And once the NATO occupation began to get out of hand, and it became totally linked to a very corrupt regime, Hamid Karzai's brother, Ali Ahmed Karzai, is well known in Afghanistan as the largest drug and arms smuggler in the country. So the regime is totally discredited. NATO is seen as defending the regime. It's done nothing for the conditions of ordinary people. And so people are going back in the direction of the Taliban, at least saying that we might get law and order. The Taliban, in its turn, is saying we've cleaned up our act, we've chucked out all the extremist elements, and are looking quite smooth. They have a press relations officer, they have spin doctors who speak to the Western media and sound quite credible. And Karzai and the United States are now making offers to them, because since Iran is now considered a big enemy and the Iranians are very strong in Western Afghanistan, they need to do some sort of a deal to stabilize the areas they control, or they fear something might happen. So Karzai has offered the Taliban a deal, lay down your arms and join the coalition government. He couldn't have done that without State Department approval. Just impossible. So the reading of the picture is that they are so desperately isolated that they want to do a deal with the Taliban. The Taliban has responded by saying, we will consider a deal with you. We're not opposed to it, but only once the foreign troops have left our country. We will not do a deal with you as long as a single foreign soldier is on Afghan soil. Well, of course, that becomes impossible for Karzai, because without the foreign troops, he's nothing.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, the prolific writer and filmmaker who originally hails from Pakistan. His latest book is Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, about the peaceful revolution sweeping across Latin America, published last year by Verso. The war in Afghanistan has virtually fallen off the radar screen. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, it's shocking, actually, Doug. This was meant to be the good war. Iraq was meant to be the bad war. Afghanistan was meant to be the good war, and they're not covering it because they're embarrassed. I mean, all they have to report is one disaster after another. It's not fallen off the radar in Pakistan, where it is reported very regularly on television networks and the print media, and it's becoming a disaster because the effect of this war is that it's spilling over into Pakistan now. And this spillage into Pakistan is destabilizing the northwest frontier province of Pakistan, and people are getting extremely worried. So something has to be sorted out on that, and it can't be sorted out while NATO is there. So then what is to be done? What to do? In my opinion, the only serious solution in Afghanistan is for the Pakistanis to give up all idea that they can ever get back in there and impose a Taliban-style government. That means, because the situation is now, will not tolerate that. That means the regional powers who are involved, Pakistan, Iran, and Russia, have to sit down together with India, which is these, you know, big power in the region, and agree to a national government, give it 5 years breathing space, give it money and help to rebuild an infrastructure, and after that have elections to a constituent assembly. I think if this is proposed, all the factions will accept it. NATO might not like it, but this is the only solution which will stop the killings. And some sections of the Taliban might not like it either, because they have these fantasies of coming back again. But I think this is the only way forward.
Let's shift to what you just called the bad war, where things are going, it seems, rather badly. The U.S., it seems, cannot afford to leave, yet it cannot afford to stay. How do you read the U.S.'s prospects?
I think the U.S. is now in a real mess. In order to leave, they need to create some degree of stability in a friendly regime, or a semi-friendly regime, in order to justify it and say, well, after all, okay, we made mistakes, we shouldn't have dissolved the Iraqi army, we shouldn't have handed over power to the Shia factions, but after long last, there is a degree of stability and we can leave. That would be perfect, but it doesn't look likely. You have a situation where southern Iraq, the British are abandoning because they can no longer afford to fight against the local militias. And British generals have said that if the bulk of the population is against us, and that becomes very clear, we're not going to fight. They said that right at the beginning of the war, not the politicians, but the generals. And this troop withdrawal, which Britain is carrying out, is partially a response to the anger on the part of the generals who feel that they are there just completely stuck for no rhyme or reason.
Some of the generals have been rather open about their discontent.
Yeah, both in Britain and the United States. I've always argued that this war showed from the beginning quite a serious split in the establishments of the United States and Britain. And this was not a split according to political lines at all. This was a split because serious figures in the American establishment, some in the foreign policy establishment, but largely in the Pentagon, felt that this was a war without purpose. They didn't know what the war aims were. They said, of course, we can take the country. What the hell are we going to do after we've taken it? These questions now all become very relevant. In Britain, the discontent within the military was even sharper. I mean, I recall a press conference between the Minister of Defense and the leading general, where the press said to them, are you prepared for this war? And the minister, the politician, said yes, and the general said no. And it created mayhem. So there was a great deal of disarray in Britain and in the United States. And they pushed this war through irrationally, and now they're paying a price for it. Now, what is being discussed is a de facto division of Iraq. Southern Iraq, Iranian protectorate. Middle Iraq, a Sunni protectorate guaranteed by Saudi Arabia and Egypt. And Northern Iraq, an Israeli-American protectorate, i.e. Kurdistan.
Turkey wouldn't be very happy with the last part.
Exactly. The Turks have made it very clear that they are not going to tolerate any Kurdish independence, for their own reasons, as we know. And Even as we speak, the Turkish army is mobilizing at the border for a raid across the frontier. The State Department spokesman today said this would be very unfortunate, and we would hope that the Turkish government and the Iraqi government can reach some sort of agreement and act together. But that's completely unlikely, because the writ of the Iraqi government doesn't extend to Kurdistan, or northern Iraq as it's known. So I think if they try and institutionalize the division that exists, it will create more instability in the region. The Turkish government, and here the military and the Islamists, are completely united. And Turkey is not any old country, it's a sort of NATO's eastern flank. So if they decide to move in, it's going to create a big crisis for the United States and for the region. So the only hope is that some form of national government will emerge and agree to keep the country united. But I'm not very optimistic, Doug, because I think things have gone really far in Iraq, and civil war style killings between the two communities have wrecked the sort of fabric, the social fabric of that society, and it's going to be difficult to put it together again. Whatever happens, you know, whatever solution is reached, what the United States has done by this ill-judged war, intervention and occupation of Iraq, they've made Iran the regional power par excellence, the strongest power in the region. Just imagine Iranian and Iraqi resources combined, or the bulk of Iraqi resources combined on the level of oil and military strength, is going to make Iran very strong, which is going to shift the balance of power in the region.
Yet it seems that practically every other week for the last couple of years, there's been a New Yorker article by Seymour Hersh saying the attack on Iran is imminent. Hearing that, it seems like the boy who cried wolf. So is it imminent? What do you make of the saber rattling?
Well, you know, I have been reading Cy Hersh, as you say, for a number of years, and I find it very unconvincing. And I'll tell you why. Because if the United States military were to strike at Iranian nuclear reactors, that's all they are. There's no nuclear weapons. No one even claims they're there. It's that they have the possibility to make them. These nuclear reactors are dotted all over the country. It's not just one complex. So for the United States Air Force to carry out raids on these nuclear reactors, they would be bombing large parts of Iran, which would be the equivalent to a declaration of war. When the Al-Qaeda hit Twin Towers and the Pentagon, the United States treated it like an act of war. They needn't have, but they did. But if you're going to bomb large swathes of Iran, the Iranians will treat this as a declaration of war, and they will fight back on three fronts, if not more. They'll fight on the Iranian border, they'll fight in Iraq, they'll fight in Afghanistan, which will extend the war front from the Tigris to the Oxus, and who knows, they might decide to fight in the Lebanon as well, and involve the Syrians. So it will create a completely unstable situation. And the Pentagon will be saying to the politicians, think carefully before you order us to do this, because we have troops on the ground in Iraq. It's one thing if we just did it from aircraft carriers and then rush back. We've got troops on the ground in Iraq. We've got troops on the ground in Afghanistan. And these troops are going to be targeted by people who are so far not targeting us, the Iranians and their close allies. So what are you doing with this bombing raid? You're putting our lives at risk, whatever the Iranians happens to the Iranians or not. And my feeling is that resistance to such an order from the U.S. Political class will be strongly resisted. I mean, ultimately, I guess they will obey orders. But I think they'll be on the verge of mutiny, which is why most of the reports being leaked out by the intelligence networks in the United States on Iran via Cy Hersh and others, I think designed to frighten people into reacting. They're designed to sort of worry public opinion, and they're designed as a shot across the bows of the Iranians, hoping they'll make some concessions, and possibly even hoping that it might, you know, lead to an uprising to topple the government. Totally unlikely. Every time the United States threatens Iran, even Iranian dissidents living in the United States freak out and said, this is merely going to strengthen the people we ultimately want to overthrow. So what the hell are you playing at? So I am not convinced, because if the war in Iraq was irrational, the war on Iran or bombing these sites in Iran would be worse than irrational. It would be sort of suicidal for U.S. interests in the region. So I doubt it very much. I've been crying out against Cy Hirsch and all the various other commentators on the left globally who've taken it for granted there's going to be a war against Iran. I'm not convinced.
I'm speaking with Tariq Ali, the prolific writer and filmmaker who originally hails from Pakistan. His latest book is Pirates of the Caribbean, Axis of Hope, about the peaceful revolution sweeping across Latin America, published last year by Verso. The atmosphere here on Amanita John's visit was quite frightening. It was insane, the hostility that was being whipped up. And also we see Hillary Clinton and some other Democrats rattling the saber. Is this just all play acting?
Well, I think it's to show that we won't be left behind. If the Republicans are engaging in military posturing, we will engage in it as well. I mean, you recall a few months ago, Obama called for Pakistan to be bombed, but then said that he would take action and send the U.S. planes into bombing Pakistan. So grotesque and repulsive. And Hillary Clinton is making the same mistake she made when the Iraq war was first mooted, backing it. Now, I don't think Iran is going to happen, but were it to happen and create a disaster, the Democrats would be as responsible for it as the Republicans. What they did to Ahmadinejad is just shocking for a great power, a strong imperial power, to behave like this to the president of a country who's visiting. Actually discredited the United States. It didn't go down too well anywhere. And, you know, describing him as a dictator and authoritarian, whether you like him or not, and I don't particularly like him, the guy was elected. He was elected in a pretty closely fought election and defeated the candidate, another cleric backed by the West, Rafsanjani, fat cat, totally corrupt, was defeated by Ahmadinejad. But you know, as we know in the case of Hamas, if people you don't like get elected, you don't recognize that an election has taken place. So I thought they behaved very foolishly in relation to the visit of the Iranian president, and it's had a very bad effect in Iran. It hasn't pleased anyone.
At the same time, the U.S. is so troubled and bogged down in the Middle East, it seems like the whole southern hemisphere is in rebellion against the U.S., led by Chavez, but he's got a lot of allies now.
He's got a lot.
What do you make of this?
Well, I think they're, you know, I mean, when you talk to some of these leaders privately, they joke about it. They say, you know, thanks be to Allah that the United States is so bogged down that it hasn't had too much time to worry about us. And meanwhile, we're going from strength to strength. I mean, they're delighted at the resistance in the Middle East, which is preoccupying the United States. And Chavez, Morales, Correa, the Cuban leadership, and people not yet in power in Latin America are plotting, you know, they talk openly about transforming the continent so that it becomes a bulwark against the empire. And they say the only way we can do this is if we are regionally cohesive. And what is interesting, I find, about South America is that even the countries which are not in favor of Chavez's domestic policies and are themselves the exact opposite of that, Lula in Brazil, Bachelet in Chile, have not really acceded to U.S. demands in relation to Chavez or Morales. Lula did not like what he was asked to do to isolate. He said, no, I won't do it. Bachelet, exactly the same. So they go a long way with the U.S. in terms of their own domestic policies, but they will not toe the line, as used to be done in the past by pro-U.S. regimes, on foreign policy. And one reason they will not do it is because these people are very popular amongst ordinary people in Brazil and Chile. And they know that it would be incredibly divisive and they might lose half their own base if they operate in this way. So the United States has problems in South America.
It's looking like the U.S. U.S. power is at the weakest, or at least the most challenged it's been since the end of the Vietnam War. So are things as bad as they look? What's your prognosis?
Well, I think it is on one level, Doug, that the U.S. is never particularly successful when it engages in direct military occupations of countries and tries to run them. Historically, the American Empire has not liked doing that. It's uneasy doing that. It doesn't tie in with the way it runs the world. It's always been the strongest when it's had intermediaries, local intermediaries running governments on their behalf. And they failed to do that in Iraq. And they failed to do that in Afghanistan, and it's backfiring now. And I think they are in a mess. I think it is imperial overstretch as far as these occupations are concerned. However, one should not underestimate the ability of the United States to recover from these setbacks. I am not one of those who believes that because they've had these setbacks, that's the end of the American Empire. One reason for that is that militarily, the United States is light years ahead of its next six rivals put together. So its military strength and its military superiority is not challengeable in the broad sense of the world, unless it makes mistakes and does direct occupations. That doesn't work. And this is so the United States has been weakened politically. It's been weakened ideologically, but I mean, I don't think it's necessarily been weakened militarily. But then you come to the question of the U.S. economy and the volatility of this economy and the total dependence of this economy on debt and the interdependence of this economy on China. And here, if things were to begin to go wrong, then there would be problems for the United States. I think the weakness or otherwise of the United States will be determined not so much by setbacks abroad, but what happens domestically to the U.S. economy. That is something which will create problems in terms of popular reactions as well. And we see the signs of it, you know, in various scandals that have taken place, hedge fund scandals, Enron, WorldCom, the crisis over the mortgages, with a desperate bank and government trying to intervene to try and stop that. But the basic structural problem of the economy hasn't been resolved. And were that to crash, then you would have interesting developments in this country.
So is the historical mission of Hillary Clinton to begin to repair all that?
Well, it is astonishing that the Republicans have been incapable of coming up with any candidate so far, any serious candidate. Hillary Clinton is tried and tested failure. I mean, after all, her husband in the White House, with whom she identified completely, it was a dual political project, as they both used to stress in the early days of the Clinton presidency, took all the measures which we are now, which Bush in many cases took further. I mean, the Patriot Act, an embryo of that was already on the statute book during the Clinton period. Against who? Against homegrown terrorists. After the bombing in Oklahoma, they were beginning to work out on how to deal with local militias. And so all these measures were being brought into the statute book. They hadn't yet been implemented. The minute 9/11 happened, Bush and his team found that Reno and Clinton had already given serious thought to these problems, and the Patriot Act was introduced. So on a whole number of series, you see that there is a continuity. I don't like this tendency among sections of the, American leftist commentators or radical commentators to say that there's a massive break between the previous regime and this one. There's a change, yes, and there's a different approach, yes. And the neocon project is quite coherent and openly stated, yes, but it's not a break with the previous regime. And I think we'll see this very clearly if Hillary Clinton wins, that she will preserve the continuity of what has been going on a number of different levels, certainly in foreign policy and also in domestic policy.
I've been speaking with Tariq Ali, the prolific author and filmmaker, who originally hails from Lahore, Pakistan, in an interview recorded a couple of weeks ago before the state of emergency was declared in Pakistan. So some of the earlier comments in this interview were a little out of date, but the underlying analysis is certainly still fresh and timely. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening.
And let's go out with this, the usual proto-weekend dance music. A little excerpt from Let There Be Light by Justice from their album Cross.